for that health and strength. It was last time, last year, that I presented and introduced Brother Ray. And I think I made mention about how we go back in years. I mean, years, you young people. You know how many, how much is 60 years? 62? Maybe 65.
Keep going.
And that, you know, Brother Nesbitt, I remember when they were working at the Middletown Hospital. So we've had a long time relationship. And I've always observed Brother Ray. He's always not only impressed me, but he influenced me. And you know, there's a natural propensity I have for Brother Ray. And I'm going to tell you why. Of course, he has a lovely wife. He does lovely services for the brethren, but I'll tell you why I have a natural propensity. It's in your name, brother.
Well,
Luke.
But Shakespeare asked, what's in the name?
What's in the name? Luke. I've been studying Luke all my life. You too have. Luke is one of the writers in the Bible. Remember? I don't know if you made a connection. He may be genetically connected with Luke. Brother, are you related to Luke of the Bible?
Spiritually.
Spiritually? How about genetically?
Well, we'll have to wait for that one. The DNA isn't in yet.
You know, don't take these things for granted. It's conceivable. And so here I am studying Luke. And is it natural for me when I open the book of Luke, I say, Ray Luke. What a privilege it is to have your name in the Bible. And although we may not know he's related to... Luke was the only Gentile, by the way, you know, that wrote in the Bible. The only Gentile. There's no other Gentiles. The only one. And he was a physician, too. So, we're delighted to have Ray here. And I see his travels. I just got your newsletter, by the way, from Africa. So, we wish you Lord's blessing in your activity. His topic today, might surprise you, Julius, Under His Wings. Brother Wright.
You have till
12 o'clock. I get overwhelmed when I have an introduction like that. It never happened before.
I thought you were supposed to stay there all morning.
You know, I... those words are far more gracious than. I bring the greetings and love of the brethren from Jersey City, Volusia. They usually send a specified text, and I confess I had forgotten just which one it is, so I'm going to substitute one of my own. Psalms 19:14. May the words of my mouth, the meditation of my heart, be acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, my strength and my redeemer. They are, the Jersey City brethren are still holding fast and want you to know how much they love you and think of you. And I know Sister Charlotte wishes she were here, and so is Sister Nancy. I will say that both of them are kind of physically losing ground, particularly Sister Nancy. And I would ask that you pray for her because her infirmities seem to be getting stronger all the time. While the flesh is getting weaker and the new creature is just abounding in spite of it all. Now, Brother Julius's remarks certainly did resonate with what I might say this morning, because we all have those Habakkuk experiences when we have to ask, how long, dear Lord, how long will evil prevail and how long will we be victims of it? And yet we have the assurance, as we've in our resolve this morning said, trusting myself to divine care, providential overruling of all my interests for my highest welfare, I will neither murmur nor repine, because faith can certainly trust him come what may. And we are to just we are to suppress any anxiety, any discontent, any discouragements. We are to allow the peace and the serenity and the will of God to overshadow all of the vicissitudes, circumstances of life, even though they seem to be so overwhelming, as we all must experience them from one time or another in our living. I often think of David in that regard, how he had to experience that as well. Particularly remember after his episode with Bathsheba, and how Nathanael told him that he would be forgiven by God, but nonetheless, his house would be troubled, and he would suffer the consequences of his deeds until the day of his death. And from that day on, we just read I wouldn't say the tragic, but rather the sad ending of his life. It was nothing but a series of, well, from the earthly perspective, a series of misfortunes. How he had to undergo, you call the hurt and the, can you imagine the trauma of experiencing in your own family where one of your own children kills another? He heard of a rape within the family, and then his own son Absalom, in this serious insurrection, seeks to usurp the throne, and thereafter there was always now incursions and invasions and struggles, and then a power struggle from Adonijah, was it, who wanted to succeed to the throne while David was still living, and he wanted to usurp the throne and had a coup d'etat all established, and how it was because of Nathan and Bathsheba telling David of this conspiracy to usurp the crown, how then finally he installed Solomon in place, and installed Solomon as the one who would be his successor on the throne, and giving these instructions to Solomon, and then realizing all the conspiracies that were just surrounding the court, his kingdom, and how to the very last breath he realized that the Lord was rebuking him for that cardinal sin that he had committed. It was in the midst of, I believe, that kind of trauma that he wrote some of his psalms, in which psalms expressed the earnestness of his experience and the full impact of what it meant to experience these emotions. And that is what makes these psalms so beautiful and so meaningful to us, how they are so filled with human feelings, and how we can enter into the very spirit of it and almost sense the emotion and the anguish through which he was undergoing. And in the 63rd Psalm, we see the little subscription at the heading, a Psalm of David when he was in the wilderness of Judea. It could be either one of two incidents in David's life. It could possibly be the one when he was a refugee from Israel. He was a fugitive who was being sought by King Saul, who was, in his jealous anger, was out to destroy him so as he might take the throne or succeed him in the throne. Or secondly, it could be at the time when he was fleeing from the danger of Absalom, when you recall at the time of that coup that he had to flee barefooted and just take whatever he could wear on his body and just flee for his life, and he was in the wilderness of Judea. In either one of those places, however, he was alone. He was desolate. He was almost to a point of despair. He seemed to wonder what had happened now to the promises that had been given to him. He was like a Habakkuk who was asking, how long? We know, dear God, that you have a future for Israel, but now how long will it be that your people will be oppressed? And here as well, echoing or re-echoing that sentiment, we have David in Psalms, just anguishing, pouring out his soul, his heart, asking the Lord and remembering the Lord and the promises and the hopes that he had. And yet undergirding it all, just like the prophet Habakkuk, he had a rock bottom faith that knew that these things were going to pass, that these were merely a transitory event in his life, and that although the fig tree will not blossom as and that beautiful scripture unfolds, how Habakkuk just reiterates his confidence and faith, yet I will trust in the Lord and the God of my salvation. And so here in the 63rd Psalm we find David as well going through that same process and yet resolving it and coming to the conclusion that yes, that faith in Jehovah will not fail and it will certainly come to pass. And he opens the 63rd Psalm, God, thou art my God, early will I seek thee. My soul thirsteth for thee, my flesh longeth for thee, in the dry and the thirsty land where no water is. You see his spirit. You see his anguish is not because of his circumstances physically, but his thirst is for God. He wants to worship God. He wants to render his service and reverence to God in a manner which would be appropriate and most helpful and useful to all those about him and for himself indeed. He was now thirsting after righteousness. My flesh longeth for thee in the dry, thirsty land where no water is. How appropriate the symbolism. Just as you can imagine a man lost in the desert without water, completely dehydrated, and wondering next how long can he endure with the heat of the day just blasting down upon him. Such a one was thirsting for water, for some relief, for some solace. Could you imagine a spiritual counterpart to that? Do we ever get to the point where we feel so athirst, so famished, so parched, that we are just longing for some semblance of God's nearness, some semblance of solace and comfort, that we might experience that oneness of fellowship that we once had with him? Do we hunger and thirst after righteousness? Do we really feel a void whenever there is a little cloud between the Lord and ourselves? And inevitably there are such events. We allow them perhaps by our carelessness, by our inattentiveness to some of the principles of God's law, and he allows us then to experience what it means to have a withdrawal of his sunshine of favor. On other occasions, the adversary sends these clouds, these thunder clouds of trouble to test and to prove and to ascertain whether or not we are able to stand under its impact. Do we then at those points have that longing, as pants the heart for water brooks, so pants my soul for thee? Do we really have that sense of absence when he is apart from us? When we miss our fellowship with each other, even to the extent of even on our Sunday worship or our daily or weekly worship, if we for whatever reason cannot be there physically, do our hearts go out, and are we thinking of the brotherhood? Are we hoping and wishing we could be with them? Even in our isolation, our hearts long and pant after the Lord as the hard pants for the water brooks. This is the kind of thirst that David experienced. And he said there's no relief, there's no water about here. But he thirsts for God. My soul thirsteth for thee. My flesh longeth for thee. It was an intense sense of communion with God that he was seeking to restore. he felt that absence, that dark cloud in between, and there was a void in his life, and he was empty and vacant, and it was a holy stirring that he could not satisfy until it be fulfilled. And he says in the second verse that that thirst is to see thy glory and thy power, so as I have seen thee in the sanctuary. Oh, that was the beauty of it. Here he was now isolated in a barren, parched desert, and he was thinking now of the beauty of the sanctuary, thinking back in his mind the beauty of the Lord's arrangement. Oh yes, this was not yet the temple. He had not been privileged to erect that temple, but yet there was a place where the ark was in a tabernacle. It was a temporary tent, if you please, or dwelling, and as it were, waiting for the completion of the temple where it would have its permanent place. But he was so eager for where the Lord was being worshipped and in communion with others of Israel, where they would all under the priesthood would be serving in the way which the Lord had ordained. This is what he was eager to see once more. He was not concerned about the pleasures of the court or the opulence of his surroundings, even though he had a grand and glorious palace in which to live himself. But here he was only concerned about the tabernacle of the sanctuary. He wanted to see the power and the glory of God lifted up, just as Ezekiel saw, you remember, as Jeremiah saw the vision of the high and lofty one, just as John the Revelator saw in the fourth chapter, he looked into heaven and he saw the glorious throne scene. Here David was privileged to see as well, God exalted and lifted up in the tabernacle arrangement. And how we, dear friends, do long to see the power and the glory seen in the sanctuary, in the tabernacle. You know, brethren, we have now a temporary abode. It's not the temple state yet. And wherever though we are as it were the temples of the living God. We are the reciprocal, or the repository, I should say, of the Holy Spirit. And where we are is the sanctuary of God. It's God's presence. And how we should be so eager to be in fellowship together with those of like precious faith. Brother spoke about the light, where we are drawn to the light because the light illuminates and it invigorates and it gives a life itself. And so we want to be united with one another. We want to be together as members of this temple class, meeting together then to glorify and to see the power of our Heavenly Father. And then he says, because thy loving kindness, thy grace, thy mercy is better than life, my lips shall praise thee. Thus will I bless thee while I live. I will lift up my hands in thy name. And then he says, my soul shall be satisfied as with marrow and fatness, and my mouth shall praise thee with joyful lips when I remember thee upon my bed and meditate on thee in the night watches. It was a total consummation. He was so enveloped in the power and in the presence and of the sense of identity with Jehovah, that he was just so filled morning, noon, and night, even in the night watches. Even when those moments in which we are interrupted in our rest, in our sleep, even in the earliest morning, my earliest thought, I desire shall be, what shall I then do unto the Lord for his benefits towards me? I will take the cup of salvation, call upon the name of the Lord for grace to help. Yes, dear friends, at all times, at all places, like the needle to the pole, our hearts are centered upon him, and upon his loving kindness, upon his grace, upon the way he has led us in the past, and then upon the way he will lead us still, and how we can then find strength, comfort, and support in that assurance, that full assurance of faith. And I will bless thee while I live. I will lift up my hands in thy name, no matter what the circumstances. I will neither murmur nor repine at what the Lord's providence may permit, because faith can firmly trust him, come what may. I will bless thee while I live. I have no reservations. My heart is open. Not my will, thy will be done. That is what David was able to say to his God as he endured this trauma, this experience of being exiled from his own throne and then being in an uncertainty as to his own future. Just earthly thinking, that would be perhaps overwhelming. But David knew that there was a future. David implicitly trusts Jehovah's assurance that the scepter shall not depart from the house of David, that he would have now a continuance of line that would succeed to the throne forever, everlasting kingdom. He did not know how that could possibly be worked, but yet God in his wisdom and in his preordained plan of the ages, he did, from the lineage of David, from the line of David would come the conquering line of the tribe of Judah, and he would be the one who would be forever in the throne, on the throne. And thus David knew that he would survive. He knew that in God's arrangements that there would be praise, but yet his heart was so consumed for Jehovah that he wanted to be as close to worship and to be as close to the center of God's blessing upon Israel in Jerusalem, and therefore his meditation was on that promises day and night. And therefore, because thou hast been my help, therefore in the shadow of thy wings will I rejoice. In the shadow of thy wings will I rejoice. You know, the shadow is a place where one can feel not the actuality, but rather the effects of the real. One sees a shadow on the ground, and one can find in that shadow a relief from the heat of the sun. It is not the tree or whatever might be casting the shadow, but it is the effect of that object. So it is with those who are in the shadow of thy wings. The wings are there. We do not have the wings, but yet we feel the effects of that wing. And what is the shadow? What is the wings that David was rejoicing in? Well, certainly he was rejoicing in the promises that were given to him by Jehovah. And they were given to him by whom? By the law and the prophets. And in the law and the prophets, in the shadow of the law and the prophets, he was rejoicing, and he was living, and he was following to the best of his ability. My soul followeth hard after thee, he said. Thy right hand upholdeth me, but these that seek my soul to destroy it shall go into the lower parts of the earth. They shall fall by the sword, they shall be a portion for foxes. But the king shall rejoice in God. Everyone that sweareth by him shall glory, but the mouth of them that speaketh lies shall be stopped. Now we see how he resolves some of the questions, how he explains his eagerness for God and to serve God in his sanctuary. And he then looks to the future where he says, the king shall rejoice in God. That is his own self. The throne shall be intact, and he shall rejoice in God's outworkings of circumstances in his life. And everyone that sweareth by him shall glory. Everyone that is in harmony with him shall be exalted. But the mouth of them that speaketh lies shall be stopped. The answer to Habakkuk's asked question, how long will evil prevail? How long will righteousness be on the scaffold and truth and evil on the throne? He says, the mouth of them that speaketh lies shall be stopped. And in God's own due time, there shall be the eradication of sin and death, and righteousness shall be laid as a line and justice to the plummet. And these same sentiments, and this same thought, is echoed again in the 84th Psalm, echoing the yearning and the almost nostalgic reflections upon what it means to be in fellowship with God and worshiping God in his temple. And in the 84th Psalm, he reiterates and he expands on the on his emotions and the ecstasy that he experiences as he approaches his worship of God in this tabernacle. He says, how amiable are thy tabernacles, how beautiful, how satisfying, wonderful is worship in thy tabernacle. My soul longeth, yea, even fainteth for the courts of the Lord. My heart and my flesh crieth out for the living God. Again, you sense the intensity of his emotions. He has the whole life is just consumed in this reverence and this high level of worship. You know, it requires a great deal of emotional cost. And for one to live at such a high point of impact, it requires a real life of concentrated devotion and consecration. One cannot understand that unless one has the Spirit of God to know the intensity of such a heart as we are examining here, and which David puts here and lays bare for us all to see. He was not a spirit begotten one as we think of spirit begettal in terms of sonship, but we can well see how the power and the Spirit of God has touched him and enabled him to achieve as high as human mind can go in his appreciation and adoration of his Creator. But we notice that again in the third verse of the 84th Psalm, he says, yea, the sparrow hath found an house, and the swallow a nest for herself, where she may lay her young. And he draws the comparison here between the sparrow, the lowliest of all, well, I won't say the very lowest, but the low on the line of creatures and animal in the animal kingdom. One of the most common and at that time the most expendable of creatures. And he said, the sparrow hath found an house, and the swallow a nest for herself, where she may lay her young. And he's comparing how the sparrow goes to the nest to nourish and to find fulfillment of life. So even thine altar, O Lord of hosts, my King and my God, blessed are they that dwell in thy house. Just as a bird seeks to the nest, so do we in our hearts seek for the Lord's nest, for the solace and for the shelter and for the protection that is there implied. And so he says, Blessed are they that dwell in thy house. Dwelling in his house, our hearts are riveted there. Our innermost being is where he is. Used to be a hymn I remembered, not too much the words, but it's to the effect of, where Jesus is heaven there. And where then he dwells, blessed are they that are there, who dwell in thy house. They will, and the psalm goes on to say, they will be still praising thee. And then he goes on to say that, blessed are they that dwell in the house, they will still be praising thee. And that same theme again is picked up in succeeding psalms. How this is a recurrent, almost you might say, major theme of David's life. You know, it's like David was writing his psalms as I think a composer might write a symphony. A composer will take a dominant theme, musical theme, a chord of notes or whatever they might be, and then weave that theme throughout the whole movement of the symphony. And each section of the symphony, the strings or the woodwinds or the percussions or whatever, would each pick up in its own turn the theme and echo and re-echo and intermingle and interchange, so that each aspect of that musical combination is given its full expression. And so David does in the book of Psalms. The theme of worship, the theme of reverence, the theme of love for God and trust in him is so intricately interwoven like a beautiful tapestry. And the whole design is just full, rich blend of mellow and of resounding, harmonious whole. And in that worship, then, we find, again, another, that same theme interplayed in the 91st Psalm. He that dwelleth in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty, under the shadow of his wings, under the shadow of the law and the prophets, under the shadow of the covenant that God had given to them at Sinai. They were now in that relationship to God so that they could claim from him all of these promises as they in turn are faithful in concluding their promises to God. And he says, I will say unto the Lord, he is my refuge and my fortress, my God, in him will I trust. Surely he will deliver thee from the snare of the fowler and from the noisome pestilence. He shall cover thee with his feathers, and under his wings shalt thou trust. And here, dear friends, is where our success, or the secret of our success, lays. He shall cover thee with his feathers, and under his wings shalt thou trust. His truth shall be thy shield and buckler. We could turn to the 12th chapter of Revelation. I wish we had the time to do it. And we would find in the 12th chapter of Revelation a very complex series of events. And one of the most difficult chapters, I think, in the entire book to really untangle. But we notice that in, I think, the 14th verse of the 12th chapter, in which these preceding verses tell of that historical events and covering a period of some 500 or 600 years, struggle between pagan and papal Rome, and how ultimately the papal Rome succeeds and then becomes now this, what we know as being the Antichrist. And in the 14th verse we find that when the dragon, that's the 13th, saw that he was cast into the earth, he persecuted the woman which brought forth the man-child. The woman, of course, being the true church. And to the woman were given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness, into her place where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time from the face of the serpent, and so forth. We know that that is the time of the period of the Dark Ages, the period of time, times and half a time, which we know is 1260 years, 360 plus 360 twice, that's a times, and a half a times is 1260. Then we have the same numbers of days given to us in the same chapter as 1260 days, and then we have in Daniel the 42 weeks, which is 1260 days. And so we see that this Dark Age period, the church was kept under the wings, covered by the wings. And what again were those wings? Well, we believe, of course, it was the covenant relationship with God, but it was then now the Old and the New Testament. They had the promises of God implicit in that covenant of sacrifice of the Abrahamic covenant given to them. They were promised under that covenant that their protection would be assured. And thus it was under those feathers. He shall cover thee with his feathers, and under his wings shalt thou trust. His truth and thy shield are thy buckler. And therefore he would not be afraid by the terror by night, nor the arrow that flieth by day, or any of the other pestilences and destructions that might lie awaiting them. He knew that he was to be secure and safe. He is my refuge and my fortress, my God, in him will I trust. I was interested. He shall cover thee with his feathers, under his wings shalt thou trust. You know, we of course could just ruminate with many other illustrations, but of course under his wings is very familiar to us when we know that God used in his terminology with Israel in Deuteronomy 32:11 and Exodus 19:4, giving them the assurance that he would gather them as eagles, and he would keep them in his nest and bless them and keep them as does the maternal instincts of even birds and animals. But you all remember, of course, the Matthew 23:34 illustration of how, oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, when our Lord, you remember, at the Temple Mount, realizing what would come, and in his great prophecy, realizing and predicting the events that would befall Israel because they rejected the one who was sent to them, the Messiah. And he said, oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how often I would have gathered thee as a hen gathereth her chicks, but ye would not. Behold, your house is left desolate unto you. And that picture of the hen and the chicks, how that so beautifully illustrates the protection that is given under these wings. And as we can just imagine, as we perhaps have seen on the front in the barnyard, when these little chicks, as they are just fearful of any enemy might be approaching, how the first thing that they will do is just run to the mother, who will just put forth her wings, and that mother hen will just engulf them, and they will be hidden safely beneath the feathers and under the wings. They are secure and safe. Oh, dear friends, how expressive and how beautiful that simple illustration portrays our trust and confidence in our Heavenly Father. That trust and confidence that David had in Jehovah. And the use of his feathers, he said, cover thee with the feathers, and under his wings shalt thou trust, was interesting to me. Yes, we believe that the Old and the New Testament are the blessings that God has to protect and to keep his people in this time of evil. But you know, the reference to his fetters, how that gave me the thought that each one of those fetters would picture a promise in the Old Testament and in the New Testament. And that these fetters are for the purpose of safety. They're for the purpose of warmth. That they're for the purpose to protect from the inclement weather. And they were so necessary for survival of the chickens. And it made me to wonder, what are the characteristics of the feathers? What is there in the feathers literally that we might apply to the lesson spiritually? And I believe that the purpose of the feathers is to lift. The purpose is to give sufficient surface to the wind so that when the feathers are exposed to the wind, the surface will have sufficient pressure applied to it by the wind as to then cause it to lift and arise. And how expressive that is in our terms. How these promises, each promise is given to us for one purpose, and that is to lift, to cause us to rise into the heavenly hopes, into the heavenly aspirations. How do we express that hymn? Oh, let our souls on wings sublime rise over the wrecks of time, draw back the parting veil, and see the glories of eternity. We sing that in our worship, don't we? But these winds, therefore, are to help us to lift our heavenly, our minds and our hearts heavenward, and to keep us centered on our heavenly home and our flight to our ultimate nest in glory. And secondly, as we intimated, the feathers are for protection against the coldness and the weather. And the feather, as is analyzed, is such a unique structure, nothing like it at all in the realm of nature, because it has a quill as its backbone, and extending on both sides of that quill is a cluster of barbs with a network of interlocking hooklets, giving flexibility and stiffness to the feather. And I'm told, or I've read, that there are as many as 300 million of such little barbs in one feather alone. That is, one feather could have as many as 300 million. And these barbs are interrelated one with the other so that there's a close-knit, tightly packed, loose connection of the barbs, which gives it flexibility and yet holds together in a solid grouping. And it gives a rise that allows the wind to come in between. And once those barbs come apart, the feathers become ruffled and flight is not possible. Oh, what a beautiful thought that is too, that these promises are all ours, and each one of these barbs, you know, are so interrelated in these promises. And if we are not understanding them, or if we are not using them as we ought, they become ruffled and they become out of connection. And we therefore lose the ability for them to bring us up into the heavenlies and to soar. Also, we notice that there are glands which, from the bird which secreted oil, which waterproofs the feathers and constantly supplies the oil to the feathers. They are constantly being lubricated, and therefore all of the water, all of the soil or the abrasive sand or whatever they might be going through is just washed off, or just it flakes off. Nothing adheres to that surface because it is so well lubricated, and it is not of the earth earthly. We often say we touch lightly the things of this earth, esteeming them only of trifling worth. We then begin, you see, to lose interest in things around us as our central concern, but our hearts are so set to the heavenly calling. Since my eyes have been fixed on Jesus, I've lost sight of all besides. So in saying my spirit's vision, looking at the crucified, there is nothing but Christ in the horizon. And the oil just waterproofs us, just gives us the lubrication that's necessary to simply slough off and to just override any of the earthly encumbrances or the fleshly inadequacies. And then too we know that the color is determined by the pigments. It is by the amount of the spirit that we have that determines color. That is also an admonition given to us, that we are to be filled with the Spirit. We are to grow from grace to grace and from knowledge to knowledge. And as we allow that Spirit to more and more fill our vessels and to lubricate our fetters, and those promises become more real to us, our colors, our pigmentation is shown, and thus we grow from grace to grace. And as Peter tells us, we are to go, put off from your faith, patience, and the patience, brotherly love, and ultimately up to the scale of love. And then you get the plumage. Then you get the colorations. Then you get really the beauty of the peacock, perhaps, or of whatever species you might think of. The just the royal majesty and the magnificent array of colorations. Then, when we have that Holy Spirit moving and actuating in and through us to the fullness that we are capable of, then we will be fully rounded and fully rounded out in the Spirit of Christ and in the love of God. This is the aspiration that these promises, that these feathers can give to us if we allow them to have their work in us. And then too, there are specialized feathers. There's the down for warmth, and there's the tail feathers, and they're large, and they kind of function as rudders. And there are the wing feathers, which kind of expand the surface, which give lift. They're very specialized in their utility. And so it is. God gives us so many different promises, and the promises of so many different ways. You remember how Paul describes it? He says that we are to, all scriptures are given by inspiration, and it's profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, and for instruction in righteousness. All of these studies, you see, have their particular purpose. There is the devotion, there is the instruction, there is the correction, and all are balanced. All the colors are in full spectrum, and the rainbow of God's love is radiated when they are all put in place. And so, we find that David, then, he speaks about the covering with his feathers, and under his wings he trusts. And I see at that time my time is gone. And so might we, dear friends, as we go through our parched experiences and through the desert of life at time on occasion. Oh yes, God gives us our reprieves, and he sends the refreshment when he realizes that it is enough, when we have learned the intended lesson. But as we are going through those moments of yes, bhaktic moments, as we go through those moments of question, let us always remember this dear, old, overcoming, well, I will say overcoming saint of the Jewish age, and that's what, you know, the ancient Buddhists are called, they're called saints. Let us recall his way of responding to his discipline by God, and we too then will be under God's wings, knowing that we have a safe abiding place, that none can harm or offend us once we are in his love and in the center of his grace.